tonight with Bill Tompkins. So, Bill, you've got that little side story, and then after that, I think it would be great if we could talk a little bit about telepathy between you and the Nordics, and about Dr. Debus and his telepathic experiences, the German disc program that he oversaw in Germany. And when you see a picture of Dr. Debus, you look at the man's face, he just looks like a towering genius. This is intensity. Remarkable man. Tell us your little side story first, though, please.
Well, I sort of covered that, where the Navy commander that had the base there in Medford did actually be assigned as a captain of that landing assault carrier. And he did last for about 8 months, and then they transferred him someplace else. The point was that this poor guy was convinced in his own mind that he was going to give the wrong command, and he was going to sink the ship. And he was scared to death of this.
Where did that come from? Where do you think that came from? That's an odd thing.
Yes, very odd. And to me and a couple of the other people in that Navy League consulate there thought that somehow, for whatever reason, extraterrestrials were playing with his head and to accomplish some sort of situation. And nobody could answer this, but two or three times later on, because we actually tried to follow his
career
mission.
Mm-hmm.
And yes, career. And it was very difficult for this gentleman, even though he's a full commander,
yes,
to accept the responsibility.
Something's not right there. That's very
something
strange.
Something was not right. Yes. Yeah. Something was influencing this fellow. Before we hit your subject there, I'd like to just say one more thing, and I'll get off of it. And this is back to Admiral Rick Abata, who's the commander of Naval Air Station San Diego, and the individual that the Secretary of the Navy had direct command to him to manage this four-year program. Actually, it was longer than 4 years, but it was 4 years for me.
Yes.
Of these operatives coming back from Germany with all of this extraterrestrial data. Now, what I'd like to do is to just touch one thing, and I would really appreciate George Fowler's comments on this particularly.
Okay.
Let me say it, okay?
Yeah.
Now, when you study Admiral Rick Abata's background, he never went to Annapolis, so he never got a bachelor or a master's or a doctor's.
Mm-hmm.
So he enlisted in the Navy as a seaman, and he worked up through the ranks to Rear Admiral. Now, stop and think for a moment. I'm trying to talk to everybody out there, but I'm particularly interested in George's thoughts. This man, where we had some 39 admirals in the Navy at that time,
mm-hmm,
and not a lot of people don't know you have that many, but San Diego operations has 11 admirals here in San Diego and Southern California. Amazing for this command right here. And you think there's just one man, one admiral running? There's 11 of them. So there's many more admirals in the Navy than you think there are.
I guess,
anyway,
yeah.
Why was Rick Abata selected? Okay? Why was Bill Tompkins selected to go do this? Because Tompkins, wait a minute, he didn't finished the first year in high school, okay?
Uh-huh.
He took some classes, but he didn't finish. He went in as a third-class seaman, okay? Now, what did that have to do with other situations of similar type of assignments? What I'm getting to here is that the Navy and industry and education has been teaching the PhDs with information that's incorrect. Every school book, if the university is being, the students are being lied to. History, mathematics, astronomy, everything is a big lie. Okay? Now, these fellows get their bachelor's, their master's, and their doctor's, and maybe three or four different technical fields. They're out in industry. They're out in companies. They're managing companies. Engineering-wise, they're doing the engineering. Mathematic-wise, they're doing the mathematics. Okay? Now, we've got some of these other people. I'll just give you an example of two. Rear Admiral Riccobata and little Billy Tompkins, who doesn't know anything. He never got taught anything. But neither one of those two individuals had a clouded education. Neither one of them had a doctor's.
Right.
Neither one of them got taught information that's incorrect. All over your planet.
Oh, I see.
All
very interesting.
All over your planet.
Got it.
Our top people in the countries have been lied to, and yes, they've got their PhDs, but that's wrong information, sir.
So you were not corrupted, Bill, is what I'm trying to get at here, I think, is what you're saying. You were not corrupted with the program.
Admiral Riccobata was not corrupted.
Got it.
His mind was open. It hadn't been filled full of incorrect information. So when you look at other people that are in the same area, take Douglas, who's chief engineer of the commercial operations at Douglas for commercial aircraft. He was the guy that came up with the narrow tube fuselage shape. He didn't finish high school. He was a draftsman.
Oh, interesting.
But he was the vice president of engineering.
Mm-hmm.
And so we've got to ask ourselves, one of the problems of disclosure, we got to think about this. One of the problems of disclosure is that we've got massive numbers of brilliant people, nice people, who have been given incorrect information about everything. And it's our task to try to convert them, get them exposed to the information, and get them to not stop it, but be involved. And actually, this is a bigger job than anybody's talking about on extraterrestrial right now.
That's a very, very interesting way to try to understand how great leaps can be made when people aren't brainwashed and conditioned to think along the party lines. They're wide open. Things can happen.
Yeah.
Great creativity can spring forth from an open mind, but not a programmed mind. I've talked to people with advanced degrees, as you have forever, PhDs, sciences, whatever, physics, and they'll tell me, look me right in the eye, there's no possible way that we can travel, or anyone can travel the great distances in space. Therefore, we cannot be visited by extraterrestrials. It is an impossibility. I have a PhD in physics or a master's degree in physics, and I know. And these people are so closed, they're concrete bricked off. There's nothing able to get through to them. They are closed and done. It's sad.
It is. Now, I'd like to talk about Dr. Michael Sell for a minute. He's not one of those people, okay? He is beyond being influenced by the studies that he had to do for all those years to get his doctors.
Right.
Bob Wood. Here's another guy. Bob Wood's got three major technical fields in his doctors. But he is different. And there's a massive number of other fellows with PhDs that have not accepted what was taught as being the absolute requirement. I've talked to Bob, I've known him, Bob Wood, I've known him for years, and he's the first one to admit that he asks questions. He wants to know why, because he doesn't accept what he's been taught. Michael Salas is the same way. Dr. Michael Salas.
Yes,
he has the same approach on this. And there are hundreds of fellows and women who have their doctors that don't accept what they've been taught as final. And so these people can then step back and look through the bigger window.
Right.
And start asking questions.
Right.
But
right. Crucial. Yeah. Don't. Okay. Worst thing in the world is to have someone tell you in so many words, don't bother me with the facts. My mind is already made up.
Right, yes.
I've got a PhD to prove it, yeah.
Yeah, okay. We're not talking about you. What we're trying to say is, let's get into the subjects you wanted to get into, okay?
Yeah, okay, very good. Dr. Debus, an amazing man. Tell us, when you first ran into him, what you know about him, what your opinion of him was as a scientist, as a leader. He was I guess he directed NASA for over 10 years.
Yes, longer than that. Yeah. My first exposure with him was when I took that proposal from Douglas that we came up with to completely change the NASA mission.
Uh-huh.
And, so I didn't have four vice presidents with me to help out in the presentation. I had to do it myself.
Uh-huh.
And everybody's read what happened when I went there and to Huntsville, Alabama, where he and Von Braun's office were. And when we got up to the elevator to the upper floor facilities and went in with this big model that I had covered up.
You took a model to one of your models to show them?
Yes, I had a 6 foot by 6 foot by 2 foot box, great
uh-huh.
big crate.
Uh-huh.
And I rented a truck in Huntsville when I got off the plane to drive this big box with this model of it. It was the launch command center. Because at the time, all programs at the Cape were operated from underground German blockhouses with periscopes. And I was having a tremendous problem getting all of a rack full of electronics into the biggest blockhouse they had.
What year would this have been, Bill, approximately? This is before 50, when be, before 50, yes. 50, go ahead.
56, 58
okay.
time period.
Dr. Kurt Debus took over as the first director of NASA, just for the record, in 1962. And was director until 1974, so it would have been 12 years. He was a giant. Nobody knows him. Kurt Debus, D-E-B-U-S. Look him up. He's a German V-2 rocket wizard who came over here with Paperclip and brought von Braun and so many others, but we only got about 30% of the pie. And look what we got. German genius took us to the stars, apparently, and then some. Okay.
Yes. Well, what I'm trying to say here is that this proposal that I gave to them, it was interesting. I drove up in front of, I rented the car and the truck. I had my model in it, and it's an open bed truck with just the boards on the side that
right,
you lift up.
Right, right.
And I drive up to the entrance of the most secret facility in the country, and the gate opens, and I drive right in. Instead of having to drive that truck over the side in the parking area, go in, fill out all the papers, have them come out and look at everything that's in the truck, I'd have to open it up. I didn't want to do that. My secretary had told me, you're going to have a surprise when you get to the gate of the base, because the gate's going to open and you're not going to have to justify your existence.
Now, she told you this. She told you this at Douglas.
Yeah, telepathically.
Yeah, I understand. I just wanted to make that clear. This is a telepathic reassurance to young Bill Tompkins. When you go back there with your model, the gate's going to open. This is amazing. What a story.
Okay, and there's all trees there, so you can't see anything but trees, even though it's a tower, like it's a 8-story building. It's a tower. But you have to get within a quarter of a block of the building before you can even see it. And I have no map. I'm just driving a truck. And I've never driven a truck with the two separate gear shifts. And so I went through red lights. I stopped at others, and people were honking their horns at me. And I'm in a business suit. And the guy that I rented the truck said, you're not the person that should be driving this. Let's have somebody drive for you. And I said, I'll figure it out. And I did figure it out, but don't tell me how. Okay, when I got to the opening where the building was that Von Braun and Dr. Debus were in, the American flag had a swastika in it.
No kidding. That's funny.
The American flag had a swastika in the middle of it. Wow.
Yeah.
Okay. Anyway, I drove past all the armed soldiers at the gate. When I got to the building, the armed soldiers there put their guns down. They came down. I parked right in front of it to the steps to go up there. The four men came down. They took off the wooden sides. They lifted up the model, and the four guys who were the guards for the building carried that model in through. The doors opened up by themselves. The second doors opened up. We walked halfway into a big office to where the elevator was. The elevator doors opened. We went up to the top floor. The box had on the side of it a big envelope which had a blue cloth. The four guards sat the model down outside of the final office. They opened up the box. They took the model and covered it with a second white, I'm sorry, they covered it with the white or the blue cloth, and they had the second blue cloth. They walked into the area between the two major areas of the conference room. It was a great big, long, beautiful marble table. They laid the first blue cloth down in the center of the table. They opened up the box with the second blue cloth covering it, and they sat it down on the first blue cloth on the table.
Now, are Debus and Von Braun in there yet?
No. And I've had no introduction to anybody.
No kidding. No one's even talked to you. You just drove in,
no,
basically.
Nobody talked to us. Wait a minute. We got three armed guards carrying a model, a big box, even driving it through the base. I don't know why somebody didn't assume I had a nuclear bomb in there.
That's quite a security issue, for sure. That's amazing.
And so my entry then, I could see on the right-hand side that there was one secretary and another secretary on the left side. The girl on the right, on the right side, smiled at me. And she stood up. And she sort of came over to me and, you're here. Okay? And I said, I'm going to bring Dr. Davis in. And so the model's sitting on this big table covered with a blue cloth. And this is a model that actually turned out to be the command launch center at the Cape. And everybody's seen this center because it's what's been used for all of the Apollo missions.
So you designed the command and control operations center for Cape Canaveral.
Yes, but it was a copy of another design that I'd done 5 years earlier inside of the tank at Douglas, which was the Army Air Force, the Air Force's Command Space Center at Omaha, Nebraska. Now, this is a facility that's 400 feet under the ground, and I have a photograph, I'm looking at it right now, that they gave me of the inside of it.
Huh.
And I still have it. And years and years later, I was working staff to the Vice President of General Dynamics Engineering, and the Air Force invited us for a secret 10-year program plan that they wanted us, they wanted to listen to theirs, and they wanted us then to make recommendations for what the Air Force was going to do for the next 10 years. This was done inside of this facility that I had designed at Douglas, you know,
uh-huh.
20 years earlier.
Uh-huh.
And so it's sort of a copy of that. And it's been the established fund for mission control that everybody's been using.
All right, let's find out what happened when Davis and the others came in. So the secretary said she will go get Dr. Davis, right?
Right. And so
what did this secretary look like?
She was, I would say, in her 40s, a very nice-looking woman,
mm-hmm.
Well-dressed. Davis' secretary looked like she was from... I'm a Von Braun's secretary, blonde girl, looked like she was from Vegas. And, anyway, they all came out, and, without any introduction, she asked me, Davis, the secretary, asked me, can we get started? So I've never said who I am, what's in the box, what's underneath the blue cloth. While I'm there, none of that ever happened.
I got to ask you one question.
Yes.
Did they know you were coming?
No. No. Every opened up. I'm trying to explain. Every door opened up.
Okay.
The gate to get on the facility opened up.
Unbelievable.
And I drive this truck. Yeah.
What prompted you, Bill, to take your model back there?
Because I wanted to show them, in another part of my background, we had these DM-18 missiles. We had other missiles that we designed.
Uh-huh,
we tested
uh-huh.
them at the Cape, and we had to use these German underground blockhouses with a periscope. And that's not a way to launch a vehicle to the moon.
That's World War II mentality. I got it. Yeah. All right.
And so anyway, I said who I am, why I was there, and I appreciate them taking a few minutes to listen to what I had to say. Davis immediately sharpened right up and started to listen to everything that I was saying. Von Braun, on the other hand, listened. He was more casual, not as involved, not listening, asking the wrong questions because he didn't hear what I said. Anyway, it went on for 3.5 hours. I presented the whole thing. 3 major changes to the Apollo program. Fantastic changes to the launch control, to the vertical assembly building, to the missions. We had done 32 different missions, which were to continue after the Apollo. And Debus, after that period of time, Von Braun thanked me for being there. Debus put his arm around me, and he said, let's go have lunch. I didn't have lunch, or Von Braun didn't lunch with us. So I came back and answered a whole bunch of questions afterward, and it's now 5 o'clock. And so Debus said, let's go have dinner to me. And so he took me out to dinner, and one of the Douglas Field managers at the base came in to where when we were talking and having a drink before dinner, and wanted me to leave Dr. Debus and come over and listen to him what he wanted to tell me. He was trying to tell me that I had been fired for what I was just doing. And I just turned around and walked away from him. He followed me, and I said, excuse me, stay out of here. And so I stayed with Dr. Debus for, this was a Monday, till Friday at 2 o'clock. He introduced me to every one of the top people in NASA. He put me on 3 separate NASA committees. Mission control, the launch control, and the facilities.
Wow. What an honor. My God, this is amazing. That's just, it just doesn't happen. And it did. It happened. He must have been so amazed at your design work. Wow.
He was, but this fellow then, he kept talking about what he had been involved in. And remember this these big German V-2 and A-4 and S-9 launch facility in Germany. Uh-huh. He ran that. He personally ran it.
Debus.
Debus. So he's not some engineer over there.
He was the head of the German rocket forces, the whole rocket program. That's incredible.
It's crazy. And so I was his buddy from then on. And he treated me like a prince. He was continually asking questions. Von Braun, we had 3 other meetings that Von Braun was in, but it was controlled by Debus. And it was a tremendous education for me that he gave me about him personally. And they have a thing called Kraut Hill down there, where all the Germans have these expensive homes, the top people. And he had one of those. And I had dinner with him and the wife and the whole bunch there one night.
What city would this have been nearest?
You're catching me.
Oh, that's all right. I mean, it's. What is the name of the facility for our listeners again?
This is the Army Air Corps, the Army's Missile Control Center in Huntsville, Alabama.
So it was called the Army. I just want to make that clear. There was no Air Force then. Not per se. This is all new territory. I am just slack-jawed at hearing this. You must have been just beyond intrigued with all of this. Go ahead.
I'm just saying, I was elated. I mean, I was just, believed everything I said, and in some cases, like a couple of my managers in engineering that were on my program, they finished the sentence before I finished.
Too funny.
Davis finished statements that I was talking to him before me. He had to have been reading my mind as to what the rest of that sentence was.
I was going to ask you, are you suspecting that he was able to telepathically get into your head?
I don't think there was any question. And what was so interesting is when I got into trouble and I couldn't think of what to do, this blonde girl back at engineering in San Diego, she'd say the name of it. She'd just give me one or two words. Bang, I'm back going again. Weird. Weird. And she's in Santa Monica, and I'm down in Huntsville, Alabama. Holy cats. We wanted to know what city it was. It's Huntsville, Alabama.
That's fine. I figured it was. That's the whole enclave there.
But I'm just saying that this fellow was a prince. He was unbelievable. I let him have a ball. And, of course, I did get fired for doing this about 3 months later. I got fired from Douglas.
Ridiculous.
But everything was implemented as we recommended. Douglas got a $76 million systems engineering contract out of it, which I never got credit for either. But Debus himself was extremely knowledgeable of astronomy. Okay? Not that he's a mathematical genius. He knew different areas of the galaxy. He had
been there.
Yes, but my understanding was that our little blonde girl there that was making her own UFOs was along with the 1,542 people mm-hmm. who are building UFOs themselves, being influenced by extraterrestrials.
Right.
That whole program was in parallel with the German program. And Debus knew all of it. Now, whether he actually knew her personally or not, he knew of her, okay? And he spoke about her. So he did not attempt, like everybody else on the German side, to cover up what she had done, what they had accomplished, okay, actually before Germany got theirs built. I mean,
Maria Orsic actually built, prior to the German government and the German engineering department in the military.
They built two UFOs. They were small ones. About several, like 10 years ago, both of them were still out at Area 51.
Wow. Well, look up, if you want to see who this woman is, look up Maria Orsic. O-R-S-I-C.
Yeah, Maria Orsic. You've got to look that girl up. Yes,
yeah.
You've got to look at what she does.
Now, at that point in time, we think in 1945 that Maria Orsic absented herself with a lot of other folks and went to another planet far, far away. That's what we think happened.
To another star's planet.
Yeah.
Okay. Not in our solar system.
Star system planet far, far away. It's quite a story. We've covered it here to a degree. Now, I've got a question. When you talked to Dr. Debus, you were there for days. What did you talk about that was what we call just friendly conversation? Did he talk about the war at all, what they were doing there, and what did he share with you, Bill?
Okay. He never said a negative word. I mean, I have to say that because his statements was always looking at essentially the future, and what he talked about and what he'd been involved in before, he talked about it in a positive manner. And so he was, his whole concepts were parallel to mine in many ways, in that he's thinking galaxy. His everything that he had accomplished in Germany before the war ended and then came to the United States was all on a positive mission type of statement. And so I never got the negative part, whereas if you listen to the two people in the conference room the first day particularly, you got negative from von Braun, you got positive from Dr. Debus. And I'm not saying that von Braun is not capable or anything like that. I'm just saying there was all a negative side from von Braun. There was always a positive effort into everything, even problems that they had in Germany. He would make it a positive outcome from the problem that was a real problem.
Von Braun was more of a Hollywood celebrity kind of a guy compared to Debus. Oh, he was a scientist and brilliant, but he was a totally different personality. You're describing salt and pepper here. I get
yeah,
that clearly.
Yeah, he was a salesman.
Yeah.
Yeah, he was the big talker. But it's not, technically, he was brilliant. I'm not saying that at all.
Oh, no,
but,
he was... Well, remember when he... Walt Disney, I believe it was Disney, featured him in a special, a television special on space and space travel and all that. And von Braun was the host of the program and was perfect at it. You can find that probably online.
Yeah, well, actually, my dad worked with that whole program, and he knew
which whole program.
Well. They made cartoons, all different types of cartoons.
You talking about and your dad knew Disney?
Yes, and he knew him personally, and he had been, we had been to Disney's house, my mom, my dad, my brother, and I.
Did you ride his little train that he had there?
I saw it, but we didn't ride it. They were very heavy on... what they were into, and they were both into extraterrestrial. So Disney knew all about extraterrestrial, and much of what he accomplished were missions of extraterrestrial. Wow.
Elaborate on that. What do you mean, much of what he accomplished were missions on extraterrestrial? What did he do? What did he do that would make you say that?
Okay, later on at TRW, one of the programs that TRW was into, where they had essentially unlimited funds to go study whatever you want,
mm-hmm.
They got into a thing that my dad had been involved in, where my dad was from Indiana, and he had been a good handler of the camera.
Mm-hmm.
And he took pictures of all the high school reunions and the graduations.
Okay, he was a photographer. Got it.
Right. So I don't want to get into all the details, but anyway, he went to work for the movie.
He went to work for Walt Disney Studios at some point, I guess. That's what you're saying? He got to know Walt somehow.
Yeah, and... But he didn't work for him. He was like a consultant for him.
Okay, very good.
Mm-hmm. And my dad worked for Warner, and he came up with some fantastic new way to make movie film extremely flexible, but extremely strong and clear. And so he was handling the development of the movie, and... movies themselves, where they would make a movie and then it would be redone in 10 or 12 different languages and be mailed out to those countries.
Uh-huh.
So this got to be so heavy that every producer of a movie used my dad's development program. They wouldn't let anybody else do it. So he borrowed some money, and he built a massive laboratory just off of Santa Monica Boulevard. I have two photographs. One of it shows the on the corner of the building, it shows a Freemason insignia.
Uh-huh.
In the second one, somebody took it off. Okay?
Uh-huh.
Anyway, what my dad was really doing was he had over like 250 or 60 people, mostly women, who converted the language to French or to every other country. And he then would put the movie in production. And
He overdubbed all the films with the foreign language versions. I got it.
And then he had, of course, the American versions, which were just English.
Yeah.
Okay. But he came up with this other thing where you see the movie, you talk to your friends after you've seen the movie, and none of you understand that you were given information. What did we just say? Everybody in the theater is given information.
Got it.
To people in France, in Russia, everybody on the planet.
Hmm.
Talk about a massive propaganda program for the Freemasons.
Yeah, mind control, mind influencing.
Yeah, massive. That my dad was involved in, he got in trouble because he said too much and he got thrown out.
So this was a Masonic venture, Hollywood Films. Your dad's motion picture film laboratory was this immense building that had a Masonic symbol on it. Then it was taken off. This is all remarkable.
I've got both the photographs.
Yeah.
Yeah, I've got both the photographs. And
tell me more about Walt Disney, please.
Okay. Disney was involved in this. And so when the kids are watching the cartoon, they're being told something.
Uh-huh.
And so you didn't just tell the grown-ups at the normal theater watching the movie. You're watching a Clark Gable movie, okay?
Mm-hmm.
But you're getting information put into your subconscious.
Mm-hmm. How is it embedded in the cartoons? What was, do you remember?
You don't see it. You do not see it, period.
Okay,
we ran into at TRW.
It wasn't audio then, subliminal audio, it was something else.
Completely different, okay? Total different system.
Wow.
And so TRW got heavily involved in this, and of course then the mind control thing at TRW is a standard. Everybody that worked on almost any of the programs was aware of us being controlled by the elite,
mm-hmm,
and or the extraterrestrials directly.
And the Masonic influence and the elite influence and the ET influence were all sort of melded together at some point.
That's correct. And really, I there's a whole book that ought to be put together on Freemasons. Yeah, we had some really good ones starting the country. Washington, D.C., architecture, the whole layout of Washington, D.C.
That's true.
Freemason.
You find it online, the aerial shots of it, the way it was laid out, and nothing was left
but
to chance.
All of this is extraterrestrial.
Oh, my. All right.
Freemasonry is extraterrestrial. And it has been going on for thousands of years. It didn't just start last week.
Mm-hmm.
Another part of this subject, okay?
Uh-huh. Uh-huh.
And so I didn't even know until my father died and his second wife called me to come to their house in San Diego, and she gave me a bunch of his stuff. In that stuff was a 33 level or above Freemason ring. I had never seen it in my life. I didn't know what my dad was doing. All of this I found out later at Douglas, at TRW, even some of it at General Dynamics. And it's a big subject. It's a major factor in everything that you're doing, everything you're saying, but it's another part of this massive...
we can call it
a control
matrix.
Ability to go into the galaxy.
And okay? it has almost no limit. This, you know, my grandfather was a 33rd degree man. He had the ring. I remember the ring. I never talked to him about it, but he had said that's what it is. And he was a Frenchman. He came over here as a kid. He had studied cooking under Escoffier in France as a boy, and he came over to New York as an immigrant and worked his way up, and he was eventually the chef at Ciro's in Hollywood for 9 years, almost 10 years.
Wow.
In the 40s and early 50s.
Wow.
Yeah.
How cool that is.
It was amazing.
That's amazing. It's amazing.
You remember Ciro's. Really? You remember Hollywood.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
It's a shame that...
we went to all those places.
Yeah, it's a shame they didn't keep all those buildings. They're still there, many of them. And it's a shame.
Yeah. They've all been redone, though, and they don't even look like what they used to be.
No, no.
But that's amazing, though, that your father was
My grandfather was the chef, the 33rd degree Mason. My father was the director of public relations at Douglas Aircraft in Santa Monica. For 16, 18 years, I think.
Wow. We're running a parallel here.
Yeah, it's strange connectivity, that's for sure. Well, Bill, we've got just about 3 minutes left. Let me go back, if I may, to Dr. Debus. Did he ever mention to you anything about the German saucer program that was originated by Maria Orsic and picked up by the SS on one wing, and the other parallel wing of that was, I guess, by the German government? There were two disc programs, as I understand it. Did Debus ever talk to you about those disc programs?
He mentioned it. But he didn't go into details, and I never realized when I was talking to him the magnitude of these two separate parallel programs. Because he countered an individual that we were talking to, one of the people I was being introduced to on the third day that I was there. And that came up then. And one time when I was talking to him on the phone, it came up, but we didn't sit down and discuss her whole program. But, of course,
much
later, we got the whole story, where she had personally been contacted by extraterrestrials to design and build a very large spacecraft transport, and then get all the family, the friends, and business associates to get on board, leave the planet, go out to another star's planet, and live a continuous life of utopia.
For those of you...
This program... the blue-eyed associate that I work with, she knew the whole story. It was old stuff to her.
Ah.
And I got most of mine from her, and then later on, the substantiation of what took place. And so Maria got contacted telepathically, then she got all of the sport to start coming up with the designs for the, at that time, electromagnetic propulsion, not...
anti-gravity.
Not gravitational.
Uh-huh.
She was to build a big transport, but she had to build at least two small vehicles, make them work, test them, along with friends, and that then ended up in my book being 1,443 people in Germany that she sort of managed to then design the large transports, all this other stuff, and of course the SS found them, found out what they were doing, confiscated everything, kept the programs going, took it away from them, gave it back to them, gave everything back to them, let them parallel the vehicles because extraterrestrials were helping them that were not the same ones that were helping
the the reptilians, and then you had the Nordics. Okay. This is fascinating. For those of you who think that perhaps none of this is true, you are invited to look up Ben Rich, the absolutely brilliant engineering genius who headed the Lockheed Skunk Works for many, many years. He was the CEO, the director, and right before Ben Rich passed away, he said some things at a meeting. Actually, it was a presentation at UCLA. And he said, "We now have the technology to take E.T. home. First, you have to understand that we will not get to the stars using chemical propulsion." And he went on from there. It's all in the, you can find it online. Ben Rich, R-I-C-H. This man had an absolutely stellar career, would never say anything to ruin or besmirch the achievements that he had mastered, especially at the Skunk Works facility. They were cutting-edge defense technology. But when he said, "We now have the technology to take E.T. home," he said an awful lot. He said there was something wrong with the equations, and we fixed them. They fixed the defects, and we think it was Maxwell's equations. You can look that up, too. We'll maybe talk more about that later. Bill, thank you. Wonderful visit, as always. We'll get our next one scheduled, and hope to talk to you real soon. That was just extraordinary.
Well, thank you. I appreciate it.
My pleasure. Good night, Bill.
Good night.
All right, the amazing William Tompkins. And what I said about Ben Rich is well worth your time. This is, they don't get any better than Ben Rich, okay? He wouldn't lie. He wouldn't make this up, especially a man who's in very poor and failing health. This is an extraordinary story. All right, we'll be back with more.